From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau here on the campus of the Tec de Monterrey.
And I am Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Congress is nearing an agreement on a $1 trillion spending bill to keep the government running now that President Trump has apparently backed off his threat to cancel government subsidies for low-income people buying health insurance, subsidies that were called for under Obamacare. But this budget bill could still be derailed by a new House Republican plan to replace Obamacare. Yesterday, members of the House Freedom Caucus approved a more conservative version of their replacement, the American Health Care Act. It needs support from moderate Republicans to pass, but Democrats say they won't vote for the budget if it does. Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News joins us. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Robin.
So help us take a look at all of this. First of all, what these Republicans are excited about is an amendment floated by New Jersey Rep. Tom MacArthur. It would essentially, as we understand it, allow states to opt out of some of the mandates under Obamacare, including covering pre-existing conditions, charging everyone the same for health care, not charging sicker people more, requiring that plans have basic benefits, including prescription, mental health care. What would this amendment do with the people who would then be dropped by states that have opted out of those mandates?
Well, it does say that if states want to waive them, that there must be some place for them to go. That could be a high risk pool, which has been have been talked about over the years, which used to exist before the Affordable Care Act, and which frankly didn't work that well. The Republicans say, well, they have some more money for them, but most analysts look at that and say it's not nearly enough. So, you know, basically what they're fighting about is the conservatives said that the bill, as the Republicans introduced it, would not have reduced premiums enough. This would be a way to reduce premiums. And it might be a way to reduce premiums for healthy people, but it certainly would not reduce premiums for sick people.
Well, you mentioned these high-risk pools that states would be required to put in place. House Speaker Paul Ryan had a press conference today. He raved about what's being called the MacArthur Amendment, but a reporter asked him, why are you using these high-risk pools? They didn't work before Obamacare. States can't afford them. And Ryan said, oh, yes, they did. So obviously they feel they do.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, Paul Ryan mentioned the one in Wisconsin, his home state. And within minutes, people had posted reports out of Wisconsin that pointed out that its high risk pool didn't cover pre-existing conditions for the first 6 months, that there were a lot of people who couldn't get in and that premiums were pretty high. So it depends on what your definition of is of works well.
Yeah. OK. The CEO of Anthem, which is one of the country's largest insurers, said yesterday that his company would leave some federal health care exchanges in place if the government stops providing so-called cost-sharing reductions. These were the things that we mentioned that were set up under the Affordable Care Act, where the government, you know, helped pay for some low-income insured when they couldn't afford it, and insurers said that they couldn't afford it. Now, we understand, you know, Republicans, you know, hated that, but we understand that under their new plan, an alternative for these high-risk pools that some Republican lawmakers are backing is an invisible risk-sharing program, a federal backstop in which the government would help pay for some of the sicker enrollees. Aren't they the same?
Pretty much. And what's complicated is that you've got two different issues on two different bills. But you're right. They wrap into the same things. The Republicans have really hated these cost sharing reductions. These are to help low income people with income under 250% of poverty pay not their premiums. That's a separate program, but their cost sharing, their deductibles, their copayments, their coinsurance. And there's a lawsuit going on saying that Congress never appropriated this money. And most experts agree that Congress didn't appropriate the money. One of the ways that they could, you know, fix the problem, insurers say they'll drop out unless they get these funds, which they are contractually obligated to provide, these discounts, is Congress could just appropriate the money. And that's what Democrats had wanted. Republicans have called it insurer bailouts. But as you point out, in their companion health bill, they have what you could consider insurer bailouts, too.
Yes.
So it's much more politics than substance right now.
But they are calling it the invisible risk sharing program. Look, what do you think in the 30 seconds we have, what do you think is going to happen with this new Republican plan?
It is very unclear. You know, Speaker Ryan said that they will vote when they think they have the votes. Clearly, that's not yet. In the meantime, you've got this funding bill that may or may not include these cost-sharing reductions, probably not at this point, and the administration that says maybe we'll keep making them and maybe we won't.
Okay. That about wraps it up. Julie Rovner with Kaiser Health News. We'll keep an eye on all of it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, here in Mexico City, there is a constant vigil for the 43 student protesters who disappeared in 2014 in the state of Iguala. But the problem runs much deeper. The National Human Rights Commission says as many as 30,000 people have disappeared under suspicious circumstances in recent years. Jesus Israel Moreno is one of them. He went missing in 2011 while on vacation in the state of Oaxaca. And ever since then, his father, Carlos Moreno, has been on a mission to find him. I spoke with him through a translator. Can you tell us a little bit about your son?
Bueno, Israel es en el momento de su desaparición en 8 de julio del 2011.
In 2011, Israel was 20 years old. He says he was an outstanding child, a son. He was a student for the National University of Mexico, who was studying geography, and he doesn't understand why someone who was like, had such a good character, actually had to face something like this.
What do you know about what happened?
Probablemente fue...
he was probably kidnapped by organized crime. Typically what happens, he says it happens, is that organized crime try to link kidnapped people to drug trafficking.
What have the authorities told you?
Bueno... ellos supuestamente hacen una investigación en el cual.
Basically, what happened is that the authorities practice what they call a verbal autopsy. What this means is that they interview some people and then they practice an autopsy of a body without having the body. So that's pretty much how they interpret the facts and what happened on that day. The witness that they used for try to describe this, they described the subject as someone who has like completely different characteristics and the color of the skin, the complexion, the weight, even the height.
So it wasn't him?
No. Nunca existió, nunca lo presentaron.
No, in fact, that body that they're talking about, they never presented it. It's not there.
So who do you blame for this at this point?
Pues definitivamente desde el procurador hasta los policías ministeriales.
At this point, he thinks that everyone is guilty from the Mexican authorities, including the Attorney General and the local authorities. He says that just the fact that they created this entire scene where nobody really knows what happened, the body that doesn't really exist, tells you that there is definitely an interest from them just to hide whatever happened. So at this point, what he's trying to do is go to international organizations such as the UN to try to get some support.
Do you feel at all in danger yourself in looking into what happened to your son?
Sí, bueno, de hecho, yo llevo 3 atentados en carretera.
He says that he's actually been victim already of several attempts to kill him 3 times in Oaxaca while he's driving on the highways there. And every time that actually he's like winning a battle against the Oaxacan government, there is an immediate reaction, something's happening.
The story of Jesus Israel Moreno is just one out of 30,000 in Mexico. I asked Juan Carlos Gutierrez, the director of IDEAS, a group that helps families find Mexico's disappeared, how there could be so many.
Sí, nosotros trabajamos en diferentes estados del país.
They work in, Sinaloa, in several states in, Veracruz, in Mexico, Sinaloa, Veracruz, Chiapas, Mexico City among them. And what this 30,000 cases reflect is that it's not a unique situation in a specific state. This is a problem that is happening in the entire country. But this number might be actually very small to what the real number of disappeared people in Mexico is, just because a lot of people don't present their cases to the authorities, and this is just the number that they give.
How much do you blame the government for this?
Creo que la historia de la desaparición en México viene...
People disappearing in Mexico is not a new story. It has happened since the 70s, but it was until President Felipe Calderón, when he started like his front war against organized crime, when these disappearances started to accelerate. So There are two main kinds of ways that these disappearances are happening. One is directly by authorities. It could be the military. It could be local police. But also the other part, and probably the one that concerns them more, is when corruption is a strong factor. And that's when the authorities are also working with organized crime. This disappearance can happen for any reason. There could be all sorts of reason. But at the end of the day, it is this situation where both of them are accomplices that concerns them.
Why do you personally spend so much time on this problem?
He has decided to dedicate his entire life and his knowledge to the cause and to try to help the situation. This is a nonprofit organization. They get fundings from even from organizations that are based in the United States. But his entire mission in life is to try to help as much as he can to solve the situation.
Juan Carlos Gutierrez, the director of IDEAS, who has dedicated his life to help finding Mexico's disappeared. I'm broadcasting today from Mexico City, where we've had a fair bit of Mexican food. Now, you can get Mexican food in just about any place in the United States, but when you come down here, it's the real deal. A restaurant called Puyol in Mexico City is arguably the country's best. It's in the swanky neighborhood of Polanco. We stopped by just before it opened for lunch. We found one of the head chefs, Coco Baker, busy at work in the kitchen.
What is this that you're slicing?
This is white onion. Uh-huh. There's some garnishes for the dishes, some sauces that we make in a minute.
It's different than the way that we would slice onions for other things. They're very, very thinly sliced.
Yeah, we call it juliana in Spanish.
Julienne would be
julienne,
the word.
Yeah, yeah. It would be in English. Yeah, it's really thin.
Yeah, we probably have about 15 or 20 people back here right now slicing things up. 15?
15 for service.
How long does it take to do all of the prep necessary each day?
It's like 10 hours of prep.
10 hours.
Yeah.
Wow. And what's the hardest thing to do?
The hardest thing to do, the mole. We make the dough, the masa for the tortillas also every day. We also make the chocolates, el chocolate de la casa, and that's it. I think it's the hardest thing to do.
The man behind all this work is Chef Enrique Olvera, who's been called one of the best chefs in the world. I sat down with him at a table in the open-air dining room. Well, Chef Enrique Olvera, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure. Welcome to Puyol.
No, say that again, because I would think if I just looked at it on a piece of paper that you would say it Pujol.
Yeah.
But it's not. Why?
It does have like a Catalonian influence, the name. I was born and raised in Mexico, but my grandfather, Enrique, had some Catalonian blood in him, and he was always very supportive of me being a cook. So I wanted to have him present in some form or fashion at the restaurant.
So the restaurant is called?
Puyol.
Puyol.
Yes.
Okay. And you started it when you were 24 years old.
Yeah, crazy, you know, that time flies in restaurants, and it's been quite a while. It's been a beautiful journey. I think the essence of the restaurant is still here, which is to have a beautiful experience dining out. Obviously, with time, we've gotten much better at doing so. In the beginning, the restaurant was much more basic. There wasn't a clear style of cooking, but I think now we've accomplished something that is very special, especially in this new spot.
What was the concept at the beginning?
The concept in the beginning was to have a small neighborhood restaurant. We wanted to do contemporary cooking. I went to school at the CIA, and I saw how the New American Cuisine movement started to become very important in the U.S., and I always thought that Mexico had a very rich cultural heritage and a beautiful gastronomic scene, and therefore we could also make new cuisine from Mexico. So we started incorporating some ingredients.
What kind of ingredients do you incorporate?
Things that we found in the market, you know, cilantro, pineapple. The first menu was French and classical, but with Mexican ingredients. So we're doing like seared foie gras with mango. That was also a dish that Jean-Georges von Richten at some point did. You could see the influence from the market. You can see the influence from my training. And then as time went by and we started to become more comfortable, we started incorporating Mexican recipes into the mix. For example, the first dish that we had that was very Mexican was the robalo al pastor. It was a contemporary version of street food, and we saw that people really enjoy that kind of food, so we started further exploring in that road using references from the streets instead of references from traditional Mexican cookery or the celebratory dishes of Mexican cooking, and we focused more on street food.
So would you say that this is new Mexican with an American influence or new American with a Mexican influence?
I think right now we've passed through many stages. I think that's one of the beautiful things about Puyol is that it's ever-changing. Right now I would say it's a Mexican restaurant with a contemporary mindset, whereas before it was more of a contemporary restaurant with Mexican ingredients.
How did you get to the point where now people are saying, this is the best restaurant in Mexico?
I don't know. You have to ask people. I guess the word the best is difficult to assess. I think quality-wise, we do our best. We buy the best product that we can from the best producers. We have really serious and committed cooks and wait staff. I would venture into saying we have the best cooks that I can say. I do not believe in that cooking is a competition, and therefore saying best, it means that you're better than somebody else. And I think we're getting a better version of ourselves. So to me, food is more about where you're at. Puyol is a really old restaurant for Mexico City standards. There's not a lot of restaurants that have been open for 17 years.
Why do you think that is?
It's a hard city. The dining scene here was very mellow until recently. There was not a lot of tourism in Mexico City until recent years. The tourism that came to Mexico City not necessarily came for food. There was more of a cultural scene going on. There's not a lot of Mexican restaurants either a few years ago. There's a lot of fondas, markets, street carts. But if you think of like a really strong Mexican fine dining institution, it's pretty recent that we started going into that world and also incorporating contemporary techniques and having a restaurant that was not traditional. I've never felt like I'm a traditionalist in the food world.
But you're still holding on to some traditions at the base of your cooking.
Yes, we're in love with our cuisine, but we believe that the best is in the future. In that way, we're very American, no? And a lot of Mexicans think the best is in the past. This city has been going on for thousands of years, and to me, yes, that is important if it makes you a better city now.
Let's talk about this space. This is a new space that you're in, and the atmosphere is very important to you as a chef and restaurant owner.
Yes, I believe that food is a big aspect of restaurants, but it's definitely not the only one, and not the one that you go out for when you're going to a restaurant like this. I think that when you're coming to a restaurant like Puyol, you do expect that everything is well-groomed, everything is well-curated, that the experience is not only of a delicious taco, but a delicious taco in a beautiful piece of ceramic, no, with beautiful music in the background by a waiter that can have a conversation with you if you want to and not if you do not want to, in a space that reflects quality.
But you even had the music for the restaurant streaming on your phone. Do you DJ this restaurant?
I do go and DJ in almost every restaurant that I own.
Wow. Now, I'm looking at your menu for today, and the one thing that is actually not printed on the menu but written on the menu is how old the mole is, 1,261 days.
Yes.
Tell us about your mole.
Mole is it's an institution in Mexican cuisine, so it was really hard for us to start touching it. We didn't feel comfortable until recently on how to make a mole that was ours, and it was a version that would be in the same stature of the traditional one. There's a saying that mole recalentado is always better. Kind of like the turkey that you do the next day in Thanksgiving. No, it's always
better in leftovers.
Right? It's kind of the same saying in Mexico. And so we decided just to start reheating the mole. Obviously, as you reheat it, the flavors mix a lot better. We obviously started running out of mole, so we had to make new mole, and we added it to the old mole. So we started like a Solera system or a Mother Dough system. And then that's how the mole madre came about. But what we like is the idea of reheating and also leaving the mole by itself. Because if you go to a wedding in Mexico, nobody will say, like, the chicken was fabulous. You always talk about the mole.
What do you think about Mexican food in the United States?
I think that it's very close to we're neighbors, so there's a huge influence, especially in the southern states of the U.S. And there's many kinds of Mexican cuisine in the United States. What people understand as Mexican cuisine in California is completely different from what they understand in Texas.
Right.
And also, I think tacos are becoming universal. No, tacos are becoming like pizza. No, pizza is probably not Italian anymore. There's more pizza eaten in Brooklyn than in Italy, I bet. So in that sense, I think tacos will become also universal.
Have you ever been to a Taco Bell or a Chipotle?
I was once in a Taco Bell when I was in school at the CIA. It was a shopping mall, and there was like a little food court. And there was Taco Bell, and I tried it once, and
I didn't never like it. Again.
No, in general, I don't like the concept of fast food, but that was just I didn't like it.
Well, Chef Enrique Olvera, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
We've got food photos at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
When wives advance economically, does that make husbands more partisan? Yes, according to researchers at Fairleigh Dickinson, who found that married heterosexual men became more partisan on both sides of the divide if their wives started to earn more money than they do. Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us in the studio. Well, this is a doozy, Kurt.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, and it comes as the unemployment rate is higher for men than for women, mm-hmm. and the number of wives earning more than their husbands has been rising steadily. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so back in 1987, it was about 18% of U.S. families where both spouses worked, where women out-earned men. That rose steadily to about 2006 to 24%. But just then, in a space of 4 years during the Great Recession, which hit men more than women, that went from 24% to 29%. Yeah. And it's even more if you consider families where only the woman works and the man is out of work.
Okay. Well, tell us about this research. It looked at, first, how views on abortion rights shifted for husbands earning less than their wives. What was the finding first for Republican men?
Yeah, so the research looked at this time period over the Great Recession where it changed quickly. And Republican men supported abortion rights less if their wives earned more over that time period. And it turns out that the more money they made more than they did made them even more
opposed.
More of a response. Yeah, even
right.
more opposed to abortion rights.
And the way the researcher knew this, is, if I've got this right, is that he was tracking people over time and came back to them. And their on the Republican side, their position against abortion rights hardened over the years as the wife was earning more. What about on the Democratic side?
Other direction. So this is what's so fascinating, that those Democratic men where you know, their wives earned more money. They actually supported abortion rights more so over this time period.
Well, it's just amazing. They also looked at government aid to low-income Americans, especially African Americans. Seems like it was the same on the Republican and Democratic side there, too.
Yeah, typically, if you just look at the men in general, as time goes on, they become less extreme that way. So Democrats might support government aid for African Americans less. Republicans might support it more. They kind of move closer to the middle. But in these families where they're being out-earned by their wives, they actually moved in the other direction, each of them.
Okay, look, this research now has to go to a psychiatrist, I think, or somebody who, you know, who can examine behavior. But there are concerns that it will impact elections because there's been research showing concern about women out-earning men decreased support for Hillary Clinton, but not for Bernie Sanders.
Right.
But why do you think it is? They're saying that Republican men were hewing to their masculinity and so hardening their views. But what was happening on the Democratic side?
Yeah, it's not clear. And this is what the big question is. It's possible. The researcher suggests that perhaps Democrats who are being out-earned by their spouses decide that, you know, maybe I just need to reject this norm of masculinity because
right.
it's working for me, where Republican men, it's different. It's not clear, but clearly, like, how much you make is such a big part of your identity and who you are, and it's affecting people in different ways.
So talk about that at dinner tonight. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thank you.
You got it.
This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Mexico City, where there's a sigh of relief today after President Trump announced that he won't terminate NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, at least not before trying to renegotiate it with Mexico and Canada. Meanwhile, Trump's push for funding the border wall is at an impasse as Congress moves forward with a wall-free short-term spending plan to keep the government funded. So how is all this playing here in Mexico? Joining us now in the studio is Rodrigo Cervantes, Mexico City Bureau Chief for KJZZ's Fronteras Desk. Hi, Rodrigo.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we're also joined by Carlos Puig, who is host of a news program on Milenio TV and a columnist for Milenio Diario. Carlos, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
Well, and let me start with NAFTA, which for months President Trump has been calling the single worst trade deal. Yesterday, he said there were pleasant and productive phone calls with the Canadian Prime Minister and the Mexican President. How does Mexico feel about NAFTA and Trump's move to renegotiate, if not get rid of it altogether?
I mean, let me put it this way. If this is the way you negotiate, which is you leak in the morning that you're about to send the notification of ending NAFTA, peso goes down 50, 60 cents yesterday. Then at night you say, hey, I called these guys, no, and I told them, okay, let's negotiate. And then you tweet this morning, today, you tweet, I talked to them, I told them I'm willing to renegotiate, but if I don't like that negotiation, I'm canceling it. I don't know if this is the art of the deal. What I know, this is the deal that is going to drive us crazy, and this is not good for Mexico.
Let's talk about what it means for Mexico. How important is NAFTA, Rodrigo, to Mexico?
Well, Mexico depends a lot on trade with the United States. In fact, one of the problems that the Mexican economy is facing is its dependency to the American economy. So approximately 80% of the products that are coming from Mexico go to the American market. That's why there's like this huge concern in the Mexican economy on how NAFTA could affect the deal.
What about the border wall? That has been in the news again this week. It looks like the Congress is not going to fund it right now anyway. Trump still sounds like he wants to have the border wall built at some point. But how do Mexicans feel about that wall?
Well, I think Mexicans feel clearly that this is a hostile announcement, a hostile intention, and this is an attack on Mexicans, that what we need is a more dynamic, better built, with more infrastructure border between the two countries. And actually, the places where we have that work much better and produce much better results for both sides of the border. So, but at the same time, we knew before Trump knew it that that was going to be difficult. And it's not only because of the money. There are a lot of logistical problems. There are a lot of legal problems to build, for instance, in Texas, because actually there's private property exactly
right.
in the land between Mexico and
right.
the
U.S. Golf courses and houses could be cut in half.
Exactly. No. Right. So I think it's more than the money, which has the wall stopped right now. But clearly, that wall is one of the reasons why if you say Trump here in Mexico, you're not going to
people.
Have
don't, I have not found a Trump supporter yet in Mexico.
Exactly.
Do you think, though, that the wall will actually ever be built?
Well, that's a big question, right? And like Carlos was mentioning, I think that one of the key words in the Trump administration has been hostility. There's this perception in Mexico about this hostile rhetorics. You can see it with NAFTA. You can see it with the wall. You can see it even since the campaign days, right, when Donald Trump started to use terms such as rapist to qualify Mexicans. So when you get like this rhetoric that's like combined, you get this idea or this notion that I'm going to build a wall. I'm going to stop having like trade agreements with you. But then the actions started to change after a few days that he's in power. That's when it becomes confusing also for the Mexican government and the Mexican population.
And if I may say something, I mean, I think that the big problem for the wall is that the promise goes with and Mexico is going to pay with for the wall, which if it gets built, Donald Trump is going to find a way for Mexicans, not Mexico, to pay for the wall. And actually in campaign, he put out a memo which say, okay, so I'm going to start taxing all the money that comes from Mexicans in the U.S. to Mexico. Or what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a special tax in export imports.
Or I'm going to raise visa fees or I'm going to have visa a border fees. Tax.
So the problem is that if it gets built, he's going to find a way to make Mexicans pay for the wall, which be, again, a hostile attitude.
Rodrigo, illegal immigration to the U.S. from Mexico has slowed way down recently. Is that a sign that people are scared of what's happening or that the Mexican economy is just doing better and so people don't feel the need as much to go to the U.S. for jobs?
What we know so far is that there has definitely been some reactions from people who were planning to migrate to the United States, or even from immigrants that are already in the United States. As soon as the elections happened in the United States, the Mexican consulate started to prepare, waiting probably for an exodus of people who would come back to Mexico. And you're also seeing like interesting patterns, not only with undocumented immigrants, but also with people who probably a year or 2 years ago were planning to go to study abroad to the United States, or they were planning to go and invest in the United States. And now a lot of these people are thinking it twice because of the situation and because of this state of instability where nobody really knows where this relationship is going to be.
You've got an election coming up next year, a presidential election in Mexico. What is likely to happen there and what will it mean for the relationship with the United States?
Well, the government is already very concerned about what's the impact of these elections on the relationship with the United States. The Peña Nieto administration is already trying to push every single negotiation with the United States so that the elections are not in the middle. So there's a huge concern of what's going to happen with NAFTA, for instance. There's huge concern on how the immigration relationship is going to be. And, of course, there's also some concern of who is going to win in those elections and how will the relationship with the United States nowadays will affect the results.
I think there's going to be a big impact of what happens in the election. I don't know what that impact is going to be. That's difficult to say. But there will be an impact because we're going to be in the middle of new NAFTA negotiations. And let me just end with this one, which is if this tax reform goes forward, if Donald Trump's tax reform goes forward, it's going to be a huge blow for the Mexican economy.
Why would the tax reform be a huge
blow
to the Mexican economy?
Well, imagine you are a company that pays in Mexico 35% of
corporate
tax.
Corporate tax.
But we have free investment right now, free trade with the U.S., and then just on the other side of the border, you're going to pay 15%. Where are you going to locate your company? Hmm. Where are you going to locate the headquarters of your company? Because trade exists. Until NAFTA keeps going, you can take the money there and keep trading. Mm-hmm. So that competition is going to be horrible for the Mexican economy if the tax plan goes ahead.
And that is precisely also why the Mexican government right now is trying to strengthen its relationships with other countries. You can see how the Mexican government is now having stronger negotiations with Argentina, with the European Union. And it is precisely because they're looking for these new partners in case that the relationship, the trade relationship, becomes so complicated with the United States that you just need like new partners, right?
Let me ask you both, finally, what is the one thing that you want Americans to know about Mexico, Rodrigo?
Well, most of us don't eat hard tacos, probably. No, I think that it would be it would be good to keep like a conversation going between both countries. At the end of the day, the United States and Mexico have a history, hundreds of years of mutual influence, right? And right now, it is a very critical moment where things are changing, but there are also some other things that are, that still connect us in so many ways.
I mean, I would say I lived for 12 years on and off in the U.S. in the last 25 years of my life. And I would say, I mean, trust what you were doing. Trust your instincts. That's what I would say to people listening to us, because people know people are people, and people talk to them every day and work with Mexicans or with Salvadorians or with Cubans or with Russians. Just keep going. Don't listen to these guys that just go crazy and start telling that every Mexican is, I don't know, whatever.
Is what?
Well, what Trump says, rapists, criminals, illegals, no, blah, blah, blah. No? So don't listen too much to Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump, and don't read Breitbart, and everything is going to be okay for you.
Okay. That's Carlos Puig, who is a host of a talk show here on Millennial TV and columnist for Millennial Diario, and Rodrigo Cervantes, Mexico City Bureau Chief for KJZZ's Fronteras Desk. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And Rodrigo has been our guide and translator here for the past week in Mexico City, so thank you for that. We couldn't have done these shows without you. We also want to thank our friends at Concepto Radial on the campus of Tech de Monterrey, where we've been broadcasting. Cuthberto Garces has been helping us here in the studio, and thanks also to Veronica Orihuela. Mark Moran from KJZZ, NPR's Carrie Khan, and Paul Vikas at Here and Now, and of course, Peter O'Dowd. Thanks all. You're listening to Here and Now.
President Trump is coming up on 100 days in office, in case you haven't heard. He'd recently said that mark doesn't matter, while pushing to get things done before it arrives on Saturday. Yesterday, President Trump issued an executive order to review national monument designations made by past presidents that could potentially open up some of that land to and water to oil and gas exploration. Another executive order on offshore drilling is expected in the next day or so. And today, key advisors and officials are meeting to discuss whether Trump should make good on his campaign promise to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. So where is President Trump on his energy and environment pledges? Lee Patterson is a reporter with Here and Now contributor Inside Energy. Hi, Lee.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So weigh in first on this meeting at the White House. Obviously, you don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but we know there's a split. We know that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Trump's son-in-law, the top advisor Jared Kushner, are in favor of sticking with the Paris Agreement. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has publicly said he wants the U.S. out. Energy Secretary Rick Perry wants it renegotiated. What's the thinking on that intra-Trump administration squabble?
There are, of course, reports that there's some serious disagreement at the top of his ranks of advisors on what to do. But I think there are two key events coming up in May that will likely force him and everyone else to make a decision. First of all, in May, envoys are planning to meet in Germany to hash out details of the Paris Climate Accords. And then also in the month of May, the G7 meeting, the group of seven leading economies, they're meeting in Italy in May. And it's expected that those leaders will likely push him strongly on the issue. So that could be the time at which there is finally a decision made. And I think the key point here is that Trump has started the rollback of many environmental and climate-related regulations. And that in and of itself will make it very hard to meet the CO2 emissions targets set out by President Obama, whether or not the U.S. pulls out of the Paris Climate Accord.
And this is why some within the Trump administration are talking about recutting the Paris deal to sort of lower the pledge of reduced emissions, which everybody says is pretty much impossible. The, you know, all the countries involved with the Paris Accord want people to meet the emissions cutting standards, not reduce them. But you make the point about President Trump rolling back some regulations. Let's listen to some of the promises that he made on the campaign trail.
Here is my 100-day action plan. We're going to rescind all the job-destroying Obama executive actions. Including the Climate Action Plan and the Waters of the United States Rule. Okay? Remember that. We're going to save the coal industry. We're going to save that coal industry. Believe me, we're going to save it. I love those people. These are great people.
Okay, so Lee Patterson, pick up there. He pledged to roll back the Climate Action Plan.
Yeah, sure, he did. And it was a couple of weeks ago that President Trump signed an executive order at the EPA headquarters, flanked by coal miners on either side of him. He actually told them at one point, I'm going to put you back to work. You're going back to work. And it was in this event that Trump signed an executive order that primarily targets Obama-era climate change regulations. And the biggie here, of course, is the Clean Power Plan. That was a signature piece of Obama's climate change agenda, and it would have limited emissions from coal-fired power plants and, of course, would have shut down, forced the shutdown of many coal-fired power plants. It also included, you know, several executive orders related to climate change. It would have lifted the federal coal moratorium. And many of these actions are more symbolic than anything else. But I think what that symbolism really is a potential rebalancing of U.S. energy and environmental policy.
Well, when you say it's symbolic, many of these jobs are not coming back because they've already been automated. Many of these coal plants are not going to reopen because the market is moving in another direction.
So, you know, just one more important point, and I'm going to quote right now a woman named Sue Kelly. She's the head of the American Public Power Association, which is a trade group representing utilities. She was speaking at an event a couple of weeks ago about utilities under Trump. And I think this quote is telling. What Sue Kelly said is this. Frankly, we've already set our course. Trump will create changes on the margins as we look at our portfolio of assets. Longer-term trends dictate what we do, and the industry doesn't turn around on a dime because of changes in Washington. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is it's some really important context when we talk about kind of the flurry of executive actions and executive orders in these first 100 days.
Well, I'm reminded, too, that this week, a dozen major firms, Shell, BP, Walmart, PG&E, sent a letter to President Trump urging him not to abandon the Paris Climate Change Accord. But on the other hand, the National Mining Association Board of Directors voted Tuesday for a withdrawal from the climate agreement. So again, it's like, you know, the markets seem to be pulling in another direction.
Exactly. And this, so much of this comes down to markets. And really, that is the price of natural gas, the price of coal, and the planning that utility companies already have in place that really looks out decades in advance.
Lee Patterson of Here Now contributor Inside Energy, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at the KJZZ Bureau at the Tech de Monterrey in Mexico City. This is Here and Now, or should I say, aquí y ahora.
You should.